Hi, everybody. My name's Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank the committee for having me come out here. And I want to thank Michael and Melissa for hosting me and introducing me to their little child, Paige, a beautiful little kid. If she never grows hair, she'll always look like Daddy. My sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a man can stay sober for over 26 years and not amount to a damn thing. I don't know if you know where you think you're going if you're new. I know you have some plans, but the highest I've ever gotten here was sober, basic human being, active member of my own home group. That's as high as I need to go. Now, I sponsor some guys who have gotten higher than that, and they're just no earthly good to anybody, you know. I'm a loser. I'm no big deal in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope I never am. I never never come to think I am. I'm just a coffee maker and a cookie lady in my own home group. You know, my group don't care I'm here. You know what I mean? They just want their coffee made on Monday and Wednesday and Thursday, you know? And you know, it's quite an honor to do these things and stuff like that, but I love being in my home group, you know? And it when you're a loser like me, it seems like when you grow up, people are always bringing people to your side to compare you to. You know what I mean? You know, why don't you be like Joey? He seems to be doing okay, you know? And that seemed to happen to me when I was in high school. I remember being a freshman in high school, and I got drunk on campus, and they took me to the principal's office, and me and my dad were in the principal's office, and my dad's sitting there looking at me, and he sees this picture of the star quarterback up on the principal's wall, number 7, you know? My dad says, "Jesus, jackass, why don't you try to be like him, you know? Why don't you try to be like Coy?" And I looked at him, and I said, "All right, I'll give it my shot, you know?" And next year, I got arrested for being drunk on campus and loaded on barbiturates, and it seemed like I stole the janitor's cart, and I ran it through the library glass doors, you know? I had to get that book back, you know? And and so me and my dad and my probation officer are sitting in the principal's office, you know, and my probation officer says, "Hey, did you ever think of being like Coy? You know, he seems to be doing pretty good." And I says, I'll give it a shot. My next year, my big sister starts dating this guy, and she brings him home. And, it's old number 7 right there in my front room, you know. And my mom comes running over in her moo-moo, "Why don't you try to be like Coy, you little son of a bitch?" You know what I mean? And I said, "All right, I'll give it my best shot," you know. And the next year, I'm getting ready to do 90 days in Torrance Jail, and a newspaper comes sliding in there, and it says that Coy makes all pro CIF, you know. And God, that guy's moving right along, man. And I thought, God, I'd like to be like Coy, you know. And what goes around comes around in old AA town. I'm about 5 years sober, and I'm in my plumbing truck, and I got my cardboard rolled up because I don't got a window, you know. Things are going well for me, you know, and in Los Angeles, on every street corner, it's vogue that somebody's selling oranges or peanuts, or they have a cardboard sign that says, "I'll work for food," you know, like you don't, you know, and gotta be from Portland, you know, when you're a loser, people are always, you know, stuffing in. I look like a guy that needs help. You know, people were walking by me, strangers, and going, "You need rehab." I've always got pamphlets stuffed in my pockets telling me that Jesus and Jehovah and all these J guys are coming to town, you know, and I better see them, you know. And I'm in my little van, and this guy with the sign locks eyes with me. And I go, "Shit, you know, I got $2 and he ain't getting it. You know, I'm a giver in AA, God, you know what I mean?" And sure enough, this guy comes running over to my van, and he sticks his head in there, and he goes, "Larry, Larry Thomas." And I go, "Coy, my God, you know." I said, "My God, you know." And I thought, Jesus, you know, I thought this guy had it made. And then it dawned on me that if there was any justice in AA, that maybe my sponsor could write this guy a letter saying, "Hey, why can't you be like Larry?" You know what I mean? But things, you know what I mean? People always look like they had it made. And my whole life, I've been obsessed with the idea that if I had some type of normal living, everything would be all right. Yet I'm an alcoholic, and the more normal my surroundings, the more irritable I become. The more restless, because I've never felt like I fit in. I've always felt like I've got weird stamped on my forehead. There was nothing odd about my family. We didn't live out in a dumpster or you know, have a bunch of lambs running around. And, I mean, you know, we're just a regular, you know, little. There was nothing I could pin my insanity on. You know what I mean? There wasn't a bunch of weird shit going on. You know what I mean? And I didn't know what to pin it on. And I was born in Detroit, and I come out to California when I was about 4 years old, brought up in a little foster home for a while. My mom and dad finally got together, and I still do, I got a great little Scandinavian mom. And my mom loved diet pills. My mom was always running around the house around midnight, sorting out nuts and bolts all night, you know, or, you know, raking the neighbor's yard around 3 o'clock in the morning and shit, you know, and just a busy lady, you know, and I mean, there was stuff getting done, you know, and she's always running around and making afghans. Everything in the house had a fresh afghan on it, you know, and chairs had afghans, couches had afghans. If there was any animals, they had a fresh vest on, you know what I mean? And everything was tight and pink like her, you know, just, you know. And when you have a paranoid mom like that, you have a lot of mom rules, you know. She don't want you to play in the gutter because you'll get polio, you know what I mean? Like, you're going to run right out there, god dang it, you know. And her favorite one was burnt food is good for your gums. Don't make that face at that burnt toast, you know. That toast is good for your gums, you know. And the poor thing didn't have a tooth in her head, you know what I mean? God damn it, you know. Her favorite hobby was to get that prescription filled, and my mom loved to eat that speed and do these 30 million piece jigsaw puzzles, you know, of the Mojave Desert, you know what I mean? Oh yeah, she's not going to be troubled by any color tonight, you know what I mean? It's going to be a beige night tonight, you know what I mean? I had no idea I laid eyes on my first tweaker at that time, you know what I mean? But there she was, and her favorite thing is she'd get her prescription filled, she'd run down to Savon's, get her a package of Raleigh cigarettes, carton of Raleigh cigarettes, because they had coupons on the back, and she saved those coupons to buy more yarn. It was a hideous cycle she was wrapped up in, man, you know? And I tell you, and she'd come home, take a couple more Dexies, you know, start putting together this puzzle, you know, and if she had a piece that didn't fit, she had a big pair of toenail clippers, and she'd snip that son of a bitch down, you know. And we were going to do some work tonight, you know what I mean? Well, let me tell you something. That diet was working. She was down to a stick. There was nothing but 50 pounds and eyes just running around the house, you know, and... But I tell you, make no mistake about that, I knew my mom loved me. I knew my mom loved me. I knew that. And that was to set a pattern with me that followed me even after I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is, whenever anybody would give me any love or affection, I would play them like a fiddle. And there would never be a time too inconvenient for me to put the touch on my mom. There would never be a time that was too wrong or not the right time for me to hit that lady, and I hit up that lady. I never want to forget what it's like to be early in my 20s and coming out of another institution one more time, or a state jail or something like that. And maybe it'd be 6 months, and my mom hadn't seen me for a long time, and it's an April morning, it's a cold morning, and it's about 9 o'clock in the morning, and it's raining, and I got my street mud on, and I'm not drunk. And I'm standing in a parking lot of a dry cleaner's where my mom's working, and I'm about from here to those glass doors. And it's a cold morning, and I'm staring at my mom and the dry cleaners, and the only thought that I have is she better have a buck for me to walk that distance, ask that lady for a dollar, and for her to open up her little Woolworth wallet with her hand shaking, and a picture of me falls out when I'm 8 years old on a Little League team, the only decent picture she's ever had of me. And she gives me $1 and then $2, and I take that money and I start heading out the door. And she said, Larry, she said, how much would it cost to get my son back? for me to take that money and run off to Wilmington where I'm going to die. Now you take this man when he comes to Alcoholics Anonymous in his so-called desperation and willing to go to any lengthness, right? And I'm here and I'm desperate and I'm willing to go to any length. How come? How come this? That if you stick a secretary that same distance as me and my mom in that parking lot, how come if I'm so desperate and willing to go to any length in AA, how come I can't walk that same distance and ask that man for a job in a meeting? But I can walk that distance and use my mom time and time and time again. And I'm here to tell you, for me, and only for me only, that if my alcoholism doesn't kill me, my selfishness and my self-centeredness will. Make no mistake about that. That the longer I stay sober, the deeper those roots of selfishness and self-centeredness go. And I never want to forget that. I never want to forget that because I'm 26 years sober, that I have some type of hold on this thing called sobriety. Because if you're new, I'll lay one little thing on you. I'll never get so sober that I can't get drunk again. But I can get so drunk that I can't make it back again. And I never want to forget that. I never want to forget what it's like to be new and standing outside of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and wondering, looking in, wondering, will I ever be a part of this thing? You see, because that's where I spent my entire life, on an outside of a building, on an outside of a group, on an outside of society, wondering, will I ever be a part of anything that's going on? Will I always be an outsider? Will there always be this mysterious barrier that keeps me from doing what everybody else is doing? You see? And because of a loving God and Alcoholics Anonymous, there's no more barriers. Sure, there's an occasional feeling of being different and stuff like that, and it's always traced back to my selfishness, but there isn't that mysterious barrier that keeps me in the depths of that alcoholism and trying to drink that barrier away to become part of something, you know? I never want to be like that again. I never want to forget that at this time that there's a man who was the sponsor of the guy that brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And this guy had 46 years a couple years ago. And he's up in Portland somewhere now, struggling, Portland or someplace in Northern California, struggling to get a couple months sober. 46 years. And they asked that guy, they said, Hap, you had 46 years, what happened? And he says, I know, I had a lot of years. Had a lot of years, but I didn't have any days. It's the days. It's what we do every day. It's what I do every day that keeps me with you. You know what I mean? Now, my dad was a happy drunk. My dad was a happy, singing the blues, Nat King Cole, Bobby Darin drunk. My dad loved to drink and sneak into his own damn house. It was an amazing thing. He's always sneaking through my bedroom window. He's got these big refinery boots on. And I can tell when Pop's coming in because he's always stepping on my chest as he's coming in there, you know. And I grabbed that boot one night and I said, my God, Dad, why don't you have Mom make you a set of keys, you know? I think you've earned them by now, pal, you know what I mean? I mean, she's up anyway, for God's sakes, you know. I can hear the Hoover going now, you know, and if she takes any more of that speed, she can make them with her teeth, I'm sure, you know what I mean? Now, there was a guy that caught my attention, was my dad. My dad was a happy drunk. My dad was a happy, singing the blues, Nat King Cole, Bobby Darin drunk. Something happened when the old man drank, and it was obvious, because he was a miserable man when he was sober, which seemed to be a trait that I caught on to, you know what I mean? But he was a happy man when he was sober, and my dad was a man of principle. My dad was a man of character and stuff, and he was a World War II vet, and he used to tell me, you don't know how good you got it. Well, boy, there's a take your inventory. You know, I've never been wrapped with gratitude. I've got to be beaten half to death to be grateful sometimes. I've never been grateful for anything, which is why I'm a loser, which is why I never hang on to anything. It's because if you're not grateful, you take things for granted. And if you take them for granted, you'll lose them, whether it be sobriety, a job, a woman, no matter what it is. I've always expected whatever's happening to me to happen. And if there was anything good to happen to me, it wasn't going to be by any effort of me. It was just going to magically come. Because I had a mysterious thing going on with me. Besides being selfish and self-centered, I had a 5-inch belt of lazy ass that straps around here where I don't want to do anything. I mean, today, I just wake up thinking about my next nap. You know what I mean? Everything revolves around the nap, you know what I mean? Oh, should I work overtime? No, got that nap at 30, you know what I mean? And I tell you, man, it just drove my dad half the, you know, and when you grow up like that and you're that selfish and you're that self-centered, what happens is when you do average things, you expect standing ovations. Yeah, I go to work and I think the boss is up in the office going, oh, Jesus Christ, my God, that guy did 8 hours work. They don't make them like that anymore, you know what I mean? Wow, and he only took an hour of lunch. We got to get more of these guys, you know? And I'm like that today. I'm like that today. It was, you know, a little while ago, my beautiful little wife, Rosie, we're both busy in AA, and when you're busy in AA, it seems like you just pass each other in the hallway sometimes. And I remember, you know, she went away for a retreat, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to put on a nice new toilet seat, nice new maple toilet seat for her. And I put that toilet seat on, man, and I was so proud. And every night we'd come home from our meetings, and she would run into the bathroom, and I'd run into the bedroom, and I would just rock. And she wouldn't say a thing, you know? She wouldn't say a thing, and I would just rock. And day after day, she'd run in there, and I would just, man, how selfish can you be? What are they teaching these women in A&A now, you know? Who does she think put that on, God? Hell, it was old Lawrence of Torrance that bolted that baby on there, man. And it drove me nuts for 3 months. I finally had to tell her. She come running out of there one night, and I said, hey, man, I said, you know, that's a brand new piece of wood you're sitting on in there, you know. She goes, yeah, and the damn thing's loose. I said, there's no pleasing these AA women around here. But my dad was this World War vet, and he used to tell me, you don't know how good you got it, and I didn't. I didn't know how good I got it. And he did really have it tough, man. His dad choked on his tongue and died when he was a young man at the age of 12 in some type of convulsion, and his mother hung herself in a Detroit jail. She was a drunken whore. He brought up his kid brother, and he had a dream. And that dream was to marry my mom, get her out of that convent, marry my mom, move out to California where everybody was making it big. He was going to get out of the Navy. He married his childhood sweetheart. And that was his dream. He had a dream. And that was to marry my mom and have a family and live the good life. He had a dream. Now, you know, for years I used to run around with this nonsense thinking that my drinking robbed me of my childhood. How selfish could I be? You know what I discovered in inventory in Alcoholics Anonymous? I robbed them of their parenthood. Snatched it right from under them at the ripe old age of 11 years old. 11 years old, I can't fit in. My ego's been satisfied every year up to then. I'm good at sports. Everything I do is easy coming. I'm getting C's in school. I'm doing good in sports. I don't seem to have a lot of trouble with people, and I get along with people. But everything I do is starting to come natural. And something happened to me at 11 years old where I was put in a position where now I had to start competing for whatever I was going to attain, and there's not a competitive bone in my body. If I can't get it naturally, I don't want it. And what happened was I realized that for those 11 years, I was seeking my dad's approval. My dad wanted me to be like this. And I got so sucked into seeking his approval, I avoided my mom like the plague. Everything was getting the dad's nod. And when I couldn't get it anymore, and I knew I failed at that, I didn't know what to do. But I knew that I could get the same relief for some odd reason. There was four of us in a garage, and we started passing around a bottle of Four Rose whiskey. And for the first time in my life, I felt better than any home run I ever hit. For the first time in my life, this loose little kid, it seemed to turn Howdy Doody into James Dean in two drinks. And everything about me, I've always felt like some type of lost crop duster flying around. And I took a shot of Four Rose whiskey and boom. I felt like a 747, man. For the first time in my life, it shut off that crap that was going on in my head. At the young age of 11, my head was hounding me. And my head's always hounded me. And it never hounds me with any good info. It just hammers me with stuff like, who in the hell do you? You'll never cut this. What are you doing? I stopped dreaming at 12 years old because every time I'd have a decent dream, my head would talk me out of it in 15 seconds. What's the use? You're never going to make it. You're never going to amount to nothing, Larry. There's something about you that ain't right. And what in my head would hammer me so much, I took a shot of this Four Rose whiskey, man, and for the first time in my life, I felt normal. That's all. For the first time in my life, man, it shut off my head, and I felt okay with me and you and everybody around me, man. I was all right. And there's nothing like feeling all right. Now, I didn't, you know, I puked and everything like that, and I didn't head out to Skid Row the next day or nothing like that, but I got the address, you know. And I never forgot that connection of where that stuff took me to. I never forgot it. And, you know, all my life I've been surrounded by kids who are natural at baseball and natural at mathematics and natural at playing the piano. This was the first thing that I ever done that came natural. Nobody had to talk me into it. Nobody had to root me on. I took a drink of that Four Rose whiskey, and I found the best thing that I've ever found in my whole life, and that was a peace of mind that shut off my head. And I tell you, from that point on, I had a reference point. From that point on, whenever I would be restless, irritable, or discontented, or would have to face some form of responsibility, that's something that made me thirsty. I ran from responsibility my entire life. There was nothing about me that, I've always had this feeling about me that I've got to leave. I mean, no matter where I'm at, I feel like I got to leave. Like right now. I've got to leave. I've got to be going here in a minute. I am not a staying guy. You know what I mean? There's nothing about me that's responsible and stick-to-itive type of guy. And that's the type of guy my dad was. My dad was the type of guy who started things and finished them. He started at a refinery as a janitor, worked there 33 years, became the plant manager, head of OSHA. Not me. You threaten me with a 401k, I'm out of town. You know what I mean? You know, I'm all about leaving. I got to go, you know. And I took a shot of that Four Rose whiskey, and there was booze all over the house. It wasn't hard to find. And, you know, when you live in a small house like that, and we didn't have a ton of dough or nothing like that, and the walls are thin, I used to hear my mom and dad at night. And I used to hear them talk. And they used to say things like, "Where did we go wrong? What did we do wrong? What should we have done better?" You know, I never went around that corner and tapped on the door and tell them, "You got it all wrong." I let them ride that pony for as long as I could. I could hear their voice today. They were scared. They were scared what was happening in the other room. Frightened to death about what would happen in there. That their little aspirations for any type of decent child has been washed away. But you know, like I said, I started going after that stuff because I knew I'd found a secret to life. And that seemed to be something that was going to plague me my entire life, and even when I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, with this obsession of being normal, with this obsession that someday if I would have some type of normal living, everything would be all right. It followed me into Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember being at my first couple meetings, and I used to watch people in AA, and to the untrained eye, it looks like that's what happens. People come here, and they stop drinking. They get a little job, they get a little room, they get a little car, they get somebody to dance with. And to the untrained eye, it looks like the solution for alcoholism is normal living. And nothing could be further from the truth. We got people sitting in this room right now who couldn't fit another car in their driveway. We got people sitting in this room right now who've got all the dough they need, but they're a little bit restless and they're irritable and they're discontented and they seem to be fed up with AA and everything's a chore and everything's a pain in the ass to do, though, because the solution to alcoholism has nothing to do with material. That just comes with hard work and good fortune. The solution to my disease, as you people have taught me, is me, you, and that book, and the perpetuation of that gift. That seems to relieve the tension in my life. That's my primary purpose. That's the thing that I'd be shooting for. But I was obsessed with this other stuff all my life. I was sure that was going to do it. And I got into high school, and I started dating this little Mexican girl, and she had some brothers who loved cars, and they love custom cars, and I love cars to this day. I love custom car shows and drag races, and we used to lower our Chevrolets down low to the ground, you know, get our hair up real big like a Bakersfield tumbleweed, and drive around, you know, and with our white t-shirts and black khaki pants that came up to here, you know, and we'd drive around and listen to the Four Tops and the OJs and Marvin Gaye and Smokey Robinson and the Temptations, and God, I loved it, man. I was in my plumbing truck the other day, the Four Tops came on, I just started sinking in my damn car, man. I I had a little Mexican girlfriend named Lupi. She had her hair curled up real high, you know, and had her eyelashes all over the place, you know, and I had my hair up real big, my white t-shirt, my black khaki pants. Some of the women were telling me that men were well endowed, had big feet. I had a pair of 15-inch shoes, you know, and driving around with my big hair and big feet and big ideas, man. Somebody tripped over my foot tonight and I felt proud, you know. Let me move that thing out of the way, you know what I mean? You know what I mean? I loved it, man. I loved it, man. We'd drive around and drink that gin and, you know, drink that 151 rum and wonder what the hell you're looking at, you know. We'd drive around with our frowns on all night because our asses hurt from bouncing around all night, man. God, I loved it, man. You know, driving into the Jack in the Box all loaded up on 151 rum, Rudy punches me and he says, "Hey, man, drive up, man, talk to the puppet." Well, I can't see the puppet, you know what I mean? But I can hear the damn kid in there. "Can I have your order, please?" You know, and I just want to run him over is what I want to do. I pull up to the puppet with my, trying to find him and talk to him, you know, and I run over the puppet. He's hanging down over there and, "Can I have your order, please?" And the cops come and they arrest me and they throw me on the hood of the car, you know, and they shatter my hair all over the place. I don't drive till I'm 30. Well, big deal. Let Rudy drive. He ain't doing nothing anyway. And there's nothing like riding shotgun, man. Nothing like riding shotgun, drinking that cheap Thunderbird wine and making the most magnificent discovery that an alkie ever makes. A mirror. And him in it. Oh, man, you want to capture a guy's attention, put a mirror in front of that alkie. He's Jesus, are you good looking. My God, you ought to be an underwear model, for God's sake, you know. You don't wear any, but what the hell? Look at you, man, you know. You got your cigarette butt stuck in your hair, you got a pound of vomit on your shirt, and you feel like doing the salsa, you know what I mean? I feel like dancing when I look like that, man. You know, and sure enough, at the end of the night, man, we go off and we go to the bar and you find her. And she looks just like you, man. She's got cigarette butt stuck in her hair, her hair's on fire, you know, and she got her lashes all over the place, and you know she's the one for you, you know what I mean? She's one hell of a gal, man, you know? She's a keeper, you know? I love sitting in meetings. There's nothing like sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with your sponsor and listening to your future wife talk. Oh, man, you're sitting there in your speaker meeting and you're listening to this girl talk, and she's telling about her trials out there and how she, all the coke she did, all the drinking she did, all the people she slept with, all the things that she did, and your sponsor's going, "Man, there's a hell of a gal there for you, man, you know." "Yeah, man, isn't she great?" You know what I mean? And I drove around with those guys, and I loved it, man. I loved everything about that, man. I ran into a kid like that not too long ago. I was up at the Glendale Mall, and this kid comes walking by me. He's got his bald head. He's all tatted down. He's got a tank top on. He's got these big pants. You could put about four other kids in there. He's got three phones because he is an important kid. He's got his mom's earrings on. He's got a hole in his ear in case you need to hook him. You know what I mean? He's got a ball bearing in his nose. He's got a ring in his eye. He's got a ball bearing in his tongue. He's got a chain to his wallet. I walk by the kid and he goes, "What are you looking at?" I says, "I don't have a damn clue what I'm looking at. I don't have an idea in the world what I'm looking at, you know. I wanted to squirt him with some WD-40 just so he wouldn't stick, you know what I mean?" And we started talking and we started laughing and I started sponsoring the guy. You know what I mean? He lived down in San Diego, Ron. He lived down in Chula Vista, man. I remember when he was new. You know, he used to call me up, you know, and, "What do you want me to do?" And I said, "Well, Jesus, Ronnie," I said, "why don't you unlock yourself, son? Get out of there, you know?" And, "Yeah, but I go to these meetings and I feel so different." "Really?" I says, "Maybe it's because you're the only one wrapped up in a chain link fence, kid. How about that, you know?" And you know, when you start sponsoring guys, they usually have your defect of character times 10, you know what I mean? And this guy was a lazy son of a gun, man. He was gonna live off the state his entire life. He was an old Navy man, and he just didn't want to work. And I told him, I says, "Man, you want me to be your sponsor, you're going to be self-supporting. You're going to go out there and do like everybody else does and get a job and put a buck in the basket, man." Well, he didn't like the ring of that, you know what I mean? Well, I tell you, man, and in a general way, I don't mean to offend anybody. After about his fourth month, this guy finally got a job, and he's excited, man. He calls me up, Sponce, I got me a job. And I said, well, great, Ronnie. I says, what are you doing? He goes, 2 to 3 times a week, I go down to a sperm bank. And this guy's all excited, you know what I mean? But, and I could just picture him every morning getting that lunch bucket, getting the old Hustler magazine, you know. Going out to that hands-on job, you know. I mean, I just, I don't know what he's thinking, but he loved it, you know. But he, I tell you, right now, this fella's still sober, and he's in Utah, and he works for Motorola or something. Just a great guy, doing well, family. But isn't it amazing, man? And I'm bouncing around with these guys, and I knew. And, you know, at this time of my drinking, man, my drinking's doing it. And the only thing that, if you're new, I can describe to you about my drinking is that every time I drank, it opened the most beautiful picture window. Boom. And I stepped into the best place I've ever been in my life. I took a couple shots of whiskey, and maybe I am in a place that is undescribable and only known by the people in this room. Only know. There is a place we go, and there is a place we get into, and that phenomenon of craving kicks in, and the whole thing is to keep that window open. Keep that baby going, man. And we are in the place that we just can't find when we're sober. And that drove me out of my mind. There is not a place that I've ever found that is that spot when I get when I am after 2 or 3 shots. And the sad thing about my life and some of the people in here is that the longer I drank, the smaller that window got. And the smaller that window got, and the smaller that window got. And by the time I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was no pretty picture. There was just this obsession that maybe somehow, someday, I could get just a little peek in a keyhole. But I know it's going to happen because I'm sober now and I'm absolutely out of my mind. There's a paragraph in this book called Alcoholics Anonymous that, if you're new, that I urge you to crack open. And I beg of you to crack open to a chapter called The Doctor's Opinion. And do your best to read that book and underline things that you identify with. And I read this chapter of The Doctor's Opinion, and I stumbled upon a paragraph and a sentence that nailed me. It says that the only answer we have is entire abstinence. And it's followed by a paragraph that says, this starts a seething cauldron of debate. You bet. I've been debating that my entire life. Abstinence drives me to drink. Sobriety drives me to drink time and time and time again. I can't stand the way that I feel when I'm sober, and I stay sober as long as I can, and I don't drink, and I go to these meetings, and I watch you do well, and that does not make me feel like a champ. And the longer I don't drink, the worse I feel. And I have this thing, if you're new, and that I hope you come to identify with, that identification that has saved my life in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope yours, is not coming here and listening to how many people had 502s like me, and how many people went to jail like me, and how many people sit out in the streets like me. The identification that I look for and that I find, and I found this weekend when Beth talked and other people, was this, that I've got the ability, I've got the profound ability, that the memory of my last drunk is never enough to keep me sober. That no matter how bad that last drunk, it hasn't sufficient force to keep me sober. And matter of fact, the memory of my last drunk, no matter how bad it is, seems to be pushed away by the pain that I feel today. And I'm not drinking over a memory of a last drunk. I'm drinking over the pain that I feel today. And I've got the ability, if you're new, I've got this thing going on with me that no matter how bad that last drunk is, I can look over a record of 20 years of drinking, and maybe you 10 or 5, I can look over years of drinking, and I can see the damage, and I can see the tears on people's faces. I can know that I've got it. I can see chunks of my liver everywhere and stuff like that. I can see consequences. I know I'm going to the joint again. I know the asylums that I've been to. I've got the ability that when I'm sober, if you're new, that no matter how bad that last drunk, after I'm sober a week or two, I come up with a profound conclusion that this time it's going to be different. This time it ain't going to get me. There's got to be some hope in this next drunk. I know there is. And I don't care what my chances are, if there's just a whisper of a chance, I will push aside everything that I know about me just for that one last chance. And this is the baffling feature about my disease. You have a normal guy get drunk with us, he'll swear off forever the next day. Oh, shit. You know what I mean? Not that alcoholic. We're over at Eddie's Liquor Store at 5:30 in the morning. Totally against our will. Out of our control. And I never want to forget that that's the insanity that I have. You know? And I'm bouncing around with these guys for a long time. And in 1969, a bunch of guys are going different places. Some of them are going to Vietnam. And some of them are going to San Francisco, turning into hippies and stuff. And I thought, well, maybe me and my buddies will go back to Detroit and find my roots. And we wound up in Phoenix. And I'm over there at Phoenix, and I'm over at the Apache Hotel, and the Apache Hotel is about four or five flights up, you know, it's a little hotel, and everybody's got a TV, and it's in the lobby, everybody's got a bathroom, and it's down the hall. It's about 35, 40 bucks a month. I don't got the dough to get it. I don't know how I'm going to get the dough to get it, and I got my little window, and I got a little room with a Murphy bed and a hot plate and a hot TV, and all I do is look out my little window, and I drink, and I dream, and I die, and I know one of these days it ain't going to be like this. One of these days, it ain't going to be that bad. I go down to the Wagon Wheel Bar where I meet this guy named Ernie. And Ernie says, Larry, he says, I know how we're going to, you know, I know a guy that is in construction and he needs some help. I want you to go talk with him. And I go to talk to this guy, and he's a plumber, and he sticks me underneath the house. He sticks me underneath there, and he says, I want you to string that copper, nail it up there, and I'll pick you up in about 9 hours. And he left me with a transistor radio. And I had a pint of Kessler's. And there was a little cat under there staring at me, you know. And it dawned on me after that guy left, I said, man, I got it made under here. I'm on top of the world. You know what I mean? I got a pint, I got a radio, got a pet. You know, I mean, I got it made under here, you know. Man, you know, I mean, when you're a loser like me, I mean, you know, I you know, my bottoms don't scare me because I just set up home. You know what I mean? And I'm underneath, man, I got it made under here. This guy ain't coming back for 9 hours. I got a pint. You know, started drinking, you know. 9 hours later, he drags me out from underneath the house, you know, and apparently I got drunk and I busted through the bedroom window floor space and I rifled all of the ladies' jewelry and diamonds and I took it underneath the house and they're dragging me out and this cat comes running out with a bunch of necklaces on, you know. So I got fired from that job. I go down to a Wagon Wheel Bar, you know, and Ernie's the idea. Larry says, not too far from here, he says, there's the horse track. He says, we're going to get you down to 95 pounds, and you're going to be a jockey. All right, man, I'm thinking we're going to start working out and stuff, you know, and he gave me a bag of speed. Now, I don't, you know, I've just been minding my own business, drinking cheap wine and doing heroin. I'm not bothering anybody, you know, and this guy gave me a bag of this stuff, and I, you know, and he says, now, I want you to take this, and in 2 months, we'll come back, and we'll weigh you in, you know, and he was sure it was going to work, you know, and he took off, and he left me in my little room. And he comes back 2 weeks later, and I didn't leave an inch. I was, you know, I don't want to be a jockey, Ernie. I'm going faster than any goddamn horse I've ever seen in my life, you know. And all I've been doing is chasing a fly around in my room, you know what I mean? And looking out these blinds every 10 minutes, you know. And I keep seeing these flashes out there, these black and white flashes. And I keep, Jesus, what's that, you know? And it was the sun going up and down, you know. He came back, you couldn't have possibly taken all that. Well, I didn't, I need some more, Ernie, you know, and I'm all sucked in. Anything that's white on the ground, I've been firing up in my pipe, you know, and, you know, it could have been a toenail, and boom, that thing's going up, man, you know. Well, so I finally found another plumber to work with, and I'm working for this guy for about 2 hours, and I find out that he's younger than me. Well, I ain't working for a kid, you know, and I did what any honorable man would do. I faked a knee injury. And he took me to the medical center, and on the way down there, I got me a pint of PM bourbon, and got my prescription for Percodan, and went down to the old Wagon Wheel Bar, and Ernie happened to know some fellas down in Tucson, and what we started doing, we started writing prescriptions and selling them, writing prescriptions for Secanol and Nembutal and Tuinol, and you name it all, I wrote it all, man. I damn near took it all, too, you know, and after about 9 months, they caught up with me. And when you're loaded on whiskey and barbiturates, there's no freeway chase, you know. There he goes, down the I-5, you know. None of that was happening. It was a matter of the sheriff coming into the Busy Bee Hotel going, Well, there he is under there. Butt naked, you know. And so they convicted me and put me away in an institution for a little while in southern Arizona. And after several months, they gave me a $45 voucher to come back to California. I came back to the LA City Hall. I registered down there. They gave me a little room in downtown Torrance, a Greyhound Hotel. Nice little room, about $35 a month. Everybody's got a TV. It's down in the lobby. Everybody's got a bathroom. It's down the hall. And I look out my little window, and I'm going, I'm drinking, and I'm dreaming, and I'm dying. And I don't know what to do with my life. My probation officer puts me on Anabuse. I don't go to AA. I haven't been to AA yet or nothing like that. And I'm 2 months without drinking and or doing any type of narcotic or anything. And at 2 months, they find me in a Little League dugout in El Segundo, California. I was working for a contractor at a refinery. I was a laborer digging ditches. And they found me in a Little League dugout at 10 o'clock in the morning, absolutely out of my mind, stone cold sober, in between maniacal and hysterical. My hallucinations had gotten so bad that I was, my paranoia was so bad that I was hallucinating and they weren't going away. And the paramedics come and they take me to a Harbor General Hospital in Carson, California, and they diagnose it in the looks of my jacket that maybe some of my drug overdoses have been suicide attempts, and by the looks of my jacket that maybe I need to go to a state hospital and be observed for 30 to 60 days. And so they sent me to a state hospital out there by Oxnard, and to be observed for 30 or 60 days, and a year later they let me out. And I was totally observed, let me have you that. I mean, I was totally observed. And they gave me stuff for my antidepressants and my antipsychotics and all kinds of stuff. And they told me that I wouldn't be able to operate in society unless I took those things. And they were absolutely right. And you know, those medications worked. Those medications for my depression worked. And the medications for my paranoia worked. But an amazing thing that these medications don't do, no matter how medicated I was, I would always adopt this idea. This time it's going to be different. And I'm still medicated out of my mind. And I'm thinking, this time it's going to be different. They can't medicate that away. They can't shock that out of you. They can't make you do enough time. In fact, there is no living condition in the world known to man that can take that out of an alcoholic. That's the baffling feature about us. And I was stone medicated, and I couldn't take it. And after 2 months, they found me over at Olvero Street. I ran out of Thorazine, and they seen me curled up at a Chevron station, a public drunk, a public nuisance. I'm no big-time convict. Please, don't get that idea. I'm a loser. I'm a loser who had no idea how to live, and I had no hope to ever live again. And they rolled me up and they sent me up to Wayside, and I'm up there for about 40 or 50 days, and they put about 50 of us in a black and white bus, and they're sending us down to the South Bay Courthouse where I'm going to be tried and convicted. And I'm sitting in a holding tank about this size, nothing but me and bologna sandwiches. I'm on a concrete floor and everybody's gone. All the buses are gone, everybody's gone, and I'm sitting on this concrete floor with this Vons bag and no hope going, I wonder where I'm going now. I wonder where they're going to send me now. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I start hearing some keys coming down the hall. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, a Scottish man with a patch opened up a jail. And he slid open a jail door and he said, "Are you Larry Thomas?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He says, "Why don't you come with me, son? You're going to AA. I said, "AA? Now, those are two initials I've never heard of before. I've heard of OR and PO, but what's AA, you know?" And who's this little Scottish pirate all of a sudden? Let me tell you about that little fella. He was my first trusted servant I've ever seen. He had no business being there. He came there unsolicited. He wasn't on a panel. He didn't work for the institutional committee. He wasn't a counselor. He wasn't a probate. He was a refinery worker who just got the worst news of his life, that his wife was dying immediately of a terminal disease. And he knew she was in good hands, but he knew he wasn't. But somewhere in his meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, somewhere in his book studies, somewhere in his 12 and 12, somewhere with working and with his sponsor, somewhere in these speaker meetings, somewhere in these meetings that you attend, he grasped and developed a manner of living, And that it was in him as one of these principles that was this. Practical experience tells us that nothing will ensure immunity from drinking than intensive work with other alcoholics. That this works when other activities fail. And he knew she was in good hands, and he knew he wasn't, and he turned his little car around, and he headed to that damn courthouse, and he talked to Judge Foy and Judge Hollingsworth, and they said, I think we got a guy for you. And that man took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. That man died about a year ago. And I took care of him. And you know what the last thing he wanted me to do at his bedside? He says, lad, would you do me a favor? Would you read me tradition number 3? Would you read me tradition 3? And I sat there and I read this guy tradition 3. And the man stayed sober for another week and took his cake and he passed. And the last thing that he told me, he says, Larry, he says, you've become busy in AA and it's good to see. But please do me one favor. Never forget the man on the bed. And you guys all seen that picture, the most famous picture in AA, those two guys and the man on the bed. Never forget that man on the bed, he said, son. Never forget where you came from. Carl Sandburg once wrote that every great society and civilization has always perished because of one thing. They forgot where they came from. That just doesn't apply to a group. It applies to me. Me and my ego and thinking what I need's good for me. Thank God for meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and commitments in them that keep me small enough to be serviceable. And my ego can't get bigger than my meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll never forget that fella. And he took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm ready for a long ride up north and maybe some lunch. And this little guy takes me for a 15-minute car ride to my first meeting of AA. And in that car, he nails me. He says, Larry, he says, I know you've had a tough life and you feel different. Bingo. I felt different my entire life, even when I'm sober. I've always got that ability to feel different no matter where I'm at and prove that I am. You know what I mean? He says, son, I'm so happy that I'm taking you to AA so that you can meet these people. He was so excited for me to meet you. He says, I want you to remember, son. He says, I know you feel different, but in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more different you feel, the more qualified you are. And that nobody comes here happy and well-adjusted. You know what I mean? And he rolled me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous to this little club in Torrance called a TLC club, rolled me up to this little dingy Alano club. What the hell's an Alano? You know what I mean? I'm thinking it's an animal, you know what I mean? Watch for crossing Alanos or something like that. Took me into this Alano club, a bunch of gypsies hanging around up there. Everybody had a nickname and a tattoo. Introduced me to the little lady named Indian Jeannie and Captain Bob and Tennessee Bill and Singing Sam and Serenity Sam and Bicycle Ray and Santa Claus Ray and Dancing Pete, Whistling Butt, all these other people, man, you know. And I'm thinking, I just left a group of people like this, you know. Everybody's running around, getting a cup on a wall or getting their brick on a wall or some crap. Little Moose come running after me, you know. Hi, honey, my name is Moose and I'm expecting a miracle. I said, I bet you are, lady. I said, I ain't it. You know what I mean? And some transvestite came out of the card room. He starts circling me like a helicopter in L.A., you know. And after about 3 times, he lands. He comes walking over and he goes, hi. He says, I can't wait to take you to a candlelight meeting. I said, I don't think so, big guy. You know what I mean? Not till I get a year anyway, you know. I mean, I got my pride, you know. And I told Alex, I said, my God, that guy's got big feet, you know, I mean. And I took one look around this room. I said, I don't want no part of this thing, man. Everybody's got a nickname running around, you know, and from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. 30 days and get drunk, and 60 days and get drunk, and 90 days and get drunk. And the longest I could stay sober was because I was on heroin. It took the edge off. And the biggest lie that I've ever told myself is that I was coming in and out of AA. I hadn't touched AA. I did what I did my entire life. I did what the losers do. They come in here and they wait to get theirs. They come in here waiting to get it. I come in here waiting for you to give it to me. I come in here waiting for something to happen to me. I'm not moving an inch until it happens to me. All my life I've had my hand out. I'm a something for nothing guy. Give me that whiskey, I'll pay you later. Give me that bag, I'll pay you later. And I had that same idea when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Sat in these rooms waiting for you to do something to me, which God was waiting to do through me. And I wanted no part of it. All I did is what I did everywhere else I went because there was no solution. I had gotten physically sober, sat here till I got mentally ill, and adopted that insane idea that this time it's going to be different. I've drunk once and made it back. I know I can do it again. And that's the only faith a loser has in AA, is the faith in his next drunk and his ability to come back. And the only thing that did for me is proved me one thing, if you're new, that if I don't change, my sobriety date will. Make no mistake about that. And I don't have the power to change. I am powerless. I had no idea what was going on. And I tell you, I never want to forget, and I mentioned a couple of minutes before, that the longest I could stay sober was 6 months, and that was because I was on heroin. I tell you, I want to tell you something that happened that day. I was sponsored by a little guy by the name of Don A., and he was just a whiskey-drinking cowboy from Montana. He didn't know anything about powder or anything like that. Just a drunken cowboy. And I remember taking that six-month chip and being loaded on that stuff. And that little guy giving me that chip. And just as happy as a hummingbird and a daisy, man. And I remember the feeling that I got. It didn't work anymore. I couldn't cut corners at you anymore. I couldn't cheat people anymore. And he nailed me. He nailed me with his innocence. He nailed me. And I knew that if I was to stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, it meant everything. And I couldn't get that cowboy out of my mind, man. I broke his heart, and it shattered a defect in me that I hope never comes back, man. I'll never forget the look of that guy, because never forget the look in his eye. And from 1980 to 1982, I'm stuck with the memory of you. And I'm living on the streets, and all I'm doing is mission hopping. You see, I'm a loser. The only thing that I'm good at is starting over. That's all I'm. You can look at my inventory, and my life is a series of fresh starts. New home, new hotel, new PO, new city. Everything's good for 90 days. You see, a loser doesn't know how to work through things. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous teaches guys like me to do. You give me this principle of stick-to-itiveness, consistency. Stay in there. I know you feel crappy, but don't quit. Don't leave your wife. Don't quit your job. It's about staying here. There's power. There's power in staying and working through stuff. And lo and behold, had I had any idea that by working through, weathering the storms in Alcoholics Anonymous, as they say, Bill Wilson says on page 13 or 14 that there'll be certain trials and low spots. He's telling you there's going to be low spots. I'm thinking I've come to Alcoholics Anonymous and it shielded me from life's little bullets. And what it does, it sticks you smack dab in the middle of life and you better have a program because they don't care. They just want their ditch dug. But I was coming in and out, and in 1980, I'm guy's doing his 12-step work and I'm up in my hotel in Wilmington. I've got my hot plate and a hot TV. I got a little room. I'm watching Jeopardy. I got a whiskey PM bourbon bottle cut in half. I'm watching Jeopardy so I could really feel like an idiot. Every now and then I get one right. Yay, you know. Donald Duck, you know. I don't need no college, you know. I hear this knock on the door, and it's this cowboy. Larry, it's Don. I said, my God, what's he doing here? I'm not even calling him, and he's coming over here, you know what I mean? And he comes and he says, oh, my God, son, you had 15 days. You had 15 days, Larry. What's going on with you? And I took a drink out of that whiskey bottle, and I told Don something I'll never forget. I said, I don't want what you got. I don't want what you have, and if I ever get that bad, I'll know where to go. Why don't you get the hell out of my room and let me do what I want to do? The cry of this alcoholic my entire life, let me do what I want to do. And the moment that I said that, it struck a chord that knocked me back in 1967 when my dad's kicking me out of the house. I'm in high school and I'm selling dope. And he tells me, if you want to live that way, hotshot, that's your business. But I've got a wife and two daughters. And my dad's kicking me out of the house, and I start fighting with my dad, and I make physical contact with my dad who just had an operation. And that was going to be something that would plague me my entire life. Oh, I would joke about it with the guys, and I would make fun about it, but it'd be one of the things that would come out in my inventory was physical contact with my father and how that made me feel. It shot me back to 1972 when my dear mom is living by herself, and it's about 1 o'clock in the morning, and her drunken son comes in through the back door. And my mom watching Johnny Carson, and I stumble in with my street mud, and my mom startled half to death, and she lays me on the couch, and she starts rocking me. And she puts my head on her lap. She's got my head, and she's rocking me. And her tears are hitting my head. And she's praying to this Michigan God, please help my baby boy. And I jump up and I said, Mom, what are you doing? Everything's all right. It ain't going to be that bad. She goes down to her room to go to sleep. And I remember that I got a pint of whiskey. That they always got a pint of whiskey up there. And I started rifling my mom's medicine chest. I started rifling my mom's kitchen cupboard looking for that half pint and for her to come down the hallway. She says, honey, what's wrong? What's wrong with you? And I start throwing my mom around until I get blood out of her nose. Demanding that she come up with that half pint, because I knew she hid it. For me to wake up the next morning to see that there was an empty in the trash can, that I drank it all and put it there already. I never want to forget that. As the only answer to my life in those 10 seconds left that room, that bald-headed carpenter. And from 1980 to 1982, I'm stuck with the memory of you, and I can't get you out of my mind. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous and you're running in and out, you may leave us, but we will never leave you. Because somehow, someday, you'll be out there capping the seal of that vodka. You're going to think about that jackass in Washington with the tie on. Or you're going to think about somebody in your meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, good or bad, that the seed's been planted. And it's only planted in Alkies. And I couldn't get you out of my mind. And on May 2nd, 1982, I'm down at the Beacon Light Mission. And I'm checking into the mission. And I'm about 120 pounds and I'm yelling. And I'm not drunk. And I see myself in a Woolworth window, and I look at myself. I said, my God, whatever happened to my dreams? All I ever wanted to be was a cameraman. How come I'm always getting drunk and always getting sober, and there's nothing in between? What's going on with me? And I got my street mud on and my hair down to my shoulders, and I'm just staring at me like I'm looking at some kind of monster. And I did what I always did when I got that way. I panhandled some money, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a hold of central office, and they called this TLC Club, and who do I get? I get Don. Hey, Don, this is Larry. Man, am I glad to hear from you. I've just checked into the Beacon Light Mission, and I'm ready to come back to AA. Will you come and get me? And he told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He said, no. He says, you know where we are. You know what we got. Why don't you get your rusty ass down here? I'm tired of chasing after you. And he hung up. And I said, my God, whatever happened to that AA love, man? You know, I just heard it. I just heard it. And for the first time in my life, it was up to me to come to you. It was no longer necessary for the good people of Alcoholics Anonymous to be inconvenienced by my nonsense. And it was up to me to come to you. And I walked that 10 miles with my poopy pants and no hope. And everything in me told me, don't do it. You're fooling yourself. This is a big, you've been here. This is a bunch of crap. They're not going to let you in. And I just went to you anyway. And I pounded on that clubhouse door, and they told me you were banned from here. And I said, I got to talk to Don. Is he here? And they said, well, we got a meeting in a half hour, but he's in the coffee room. And I waddled up to Don with my poopy pants and no hope, and I asked him something I never asked a man in Alcoholics. I didn't ask him a dollar. I didn't ask him for a ride home. I said, Don, I don't know what to do with my life anymore. Would you be my sponsor? And that guy lit up like a chandelier for about 10 seconds, and then he lit into me for about 20 minutes. And he told me under no certain terms was he going to put up with my nonsense. And he wrapped me in love. You betcha. Nothing more powerful than a sponsorship. I love that man to death, man. And he told me to stay at that dingy club that he was going to work, and he said, I want you to stay here. And he took off to work, and he said, you better be here for the Thursday night meeting tonight. And I stayed there, and I hallucinated, and I threw up, And I had my convulsions, and I was held by two drunks in Alcoholics Anonymous, Frank and Lucille. And all I could do was drink buttermilk. And they gave me honey and orange juice. They didn't run me off to some detox. They didn't run me off to some hospital. I shook it out with the drunks. And they stood me up at that Thursday night meeting, and I said, my name's Larry Thomas, I'm an alcoholic, and for the first time in my life, I felt like a member. For the first time in my life, I had an idea of maybe what an alcoholic was. That an alcoholic maybe isn't somebody who can't drink again or shouldn't drink again. That I'm an alcoholic. I'm gonna drink again. Everything in me is faced that way. Everything in me is faced that way. And there's nothing between me and that next drink except for you and this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I better dive into it, hook, line, or sinker, because I'll never get so sober that I can't get drunk again. I don't care how many spiritual experiences I have. If I'm not working with newcomers and in the middle of you, I'm a dead man. It ain't about getting anything. I'm not here in Washington to get a damn thing. I'm here to thank you for everything you got. I stopped asking for things a long time ago. I don't have any more ask me prayers. I don't have any give me prayers. My day starts off with a thank you. And these things that were obligations and pain in the asses to do, isn't it amazing that over a period of time how they become privileges in your life? The privileges of having sponsors and having meetings and stuff like that. A unique thing that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous, who can turn a drunken loser like me into some form of a man. I didn't know what a man was. It took my sponsor that I got now for 24 years. We finally did an inventory, and in that inventory, he showed me what kind of man I was. He showed me exactly what kind of man I was. There was nothing about me that represented a man. There was nothing about me that taught me how to treat a child or a woman or anything like that. It was all about me. Everything in it was about me. And we took that inventory and we made these amends to people. We didn't run off to bartenders and dope dealers. He got me back to my family. He got me back to my mother and father. He sat me down with them and I had these amends to make. And it took more than a letter and a dinner, for God's sakes. It took for them to see me, and they didn't trust me, and they shouldn't be. But what I did started doing is this time when I got sober, I quit announcing my sobriety to everybody. I quit telling everybody I was sober again and building up their hopes. Hell, my mom was so scared when I said I was in AA because she thought I was going to get drunk again. So I stopped announcing my sobriety. And if you want to talk to your sponsor, your parents, my sponsor said, just ask them how they're doing. Tell them you're doing fine. But my God, he says, wait till you get on your feet before you start telling them you're sober again. And I started getting back together with my family. And I got to become friends with my mother and father, the two most beautiful people in my life. And I told you guys earlier about the relationship that I had with my dad and the most beautiful one that I have with my mom to this day. Last Mother's Day passed. And I asked my mom, what do you want? She says, honey, every day you call me in the morning, I have the best Mother's Day gift I can ask for. You gave me back to give to her peace of mind. That's the magic of these amends. You give them back their peace of mind. Not overnight. Not overnight at all. And in some of these amends, I was so afraid to make. Not all my amends came out beautiful. There were some people that didn't want to see me, man. There was one guy who I went to high school with. Me and him used to do dope and drink together. And while he was gone on vacation, I robbed his house. And I robbed his house and I took his dad's coin collection. And I took the coin collection to a pawn shop. I got about $600-$700 and I bought some dope with it and I sold it to him. You know? Well, I'm sober in AA. I'm about 5-6 years sober, and I'm doing, you know, I'm going through the process, and I'm over at a place called Montgomery Ward. It was like a Sears, and I'm going up the escalator, and my school buddy Jeff is going down the escalator. Hey, Larry. Hey, Jeff. And we start talking, and we started telling him, and he says, how you doing? And I start telling, I says, is your dad still around? He says, yeah, he still lives over at Red Beam. And I had to go to Red Beam Avenue because his dad was on my amends list. And I told my sponsor, I always go to my sponsor before I make my amends because I get goofy ideas. And my sponsor says, I tell you what you do. He says, you better take a little check and you better tell this guy what's going on. And let me know what happens. And I drive up, and there's this big driveway, and his dad's a hunter. And I'm walking up this driveway, and I hear this, Jesus Christ, you know, I'm thinking the guy's got a double barrel pinning me down as I'm coming up there, and the guy's packing shotgun shells. And I walk up there, and there's a little light in the garage, and I said, Mr. Maffin? He goes, yes. And I says, can I talk to you? And he goes, who are you? I says, my name is Larry, and I was a friend of your son's in high school. And I hear this, you know what I mean? And he says, what in the hell do you want? And I says, well, I need to talk to you about something. He says, you better make it quick. And I went up to the man, and I said, in 1967, you went on vacation, and I robbed your house, and I stole the coin collection. And the guy whipped around, and he looked at me, and he says, you're damn right you did. And he says, I want to tell you about that coin collection, hotshot. He says, my dad died, and the only thing he left me was his coin collection. And you stole that from me, you son of a... He says, I don't care if you're hanging on the cross with Jesus. You get the hell off my property before I shoot you, and take this $20 check and stick it where the moon don't shine. Okay. You know what I mean? My sponsor told me to keep sending that guy that money. Not everybody's going to be thrilled to see you, for God's sakes. But I realized what I stole from that man. I realized on this one amends that there was this girl that I was living with, and that during my drunkenness, because I'm such a macho loser, I used to move her around physically. And her father came over and kicked me out of the apartment because he was tired of her daughter calling him up because I'm moving her around. And he came over with a shotgun. That's how I moved, you know. And he told me to get the hell out of her life and pack up my stuff in a pillowcase and get the hell out of there. And I left that. And I remember getting sober and writing that guy or that little lady a letter. My sponsor says, do you know where she's living at? And I said, well, yeah, my mom got the address because she found out where he was. He says, why don't you write that little girl a letter, that young lady a letter, and let her know, and just start from there. Well, I wrote that lady that I used to live with a letter, and I made amends, and I told her how I regret doing those things to her. And I told her about you, and I mailed off the letter. 10 years go by, and I never hear about it. And I'm speaking at a meeting in Manhattan Beach, California. And at the end of the meeting, there's a little fella standing at the doorway, a little shriveled up little guy with gray hair. And he comes up to me, and he says, I don't know if you remember me, but my name is Tom. And he says, you used to live with my daughter, Fritzy. I says, yes, sir. And he says, I need to talk to you. And I said, oh, shit, you know. And he took me outside, and he said, I want you to know something. He says, I've got 3 years sobriety because of you. I says, I don't get it, Tom. I says, I've been sober a little long. He says, no. He says, you need to listen to this, son. He says, when my daughter got your letter, whenever your name was on things, we read it. And I read that letter you wrote my daughter. And when I wanted to get sober, it dawned on me, your letter, that if AA can make a jackass like you write a letter like that, then maybe it's worth investigating. And he'd been sober ever since, you know. And I tell you, it's you never know what's going to happen. You just take the action. You take that action. Now, there was a little girl that I wasn't supposed to see, my little baby Lauren. I had my only time I was married is when I was 5 years sober in AA. That was the first time I was ever married. It lasted a whole year and a half. And I had to leave my little girl, my little daughter Lauren. It was the hardest thing for me to do. And when she was 10, her and her mom moved to Phoenix. And every time I would pick that little girl up, I started noticing that she would have holes in her underwear and holes in her socks. And I'd realize that was my fault. That the big macho man in Alcoholics Anonymous couldn't hold a job. And you know why that was? It's because I had to be right. You see, I had a resentment towards my first wife. And that resentment was, she ain't going to get a penny. And you know how you do that, men? You stay poor at them. You stay poor, Adam, and you don't hold a job, and you don't pay your child support, and you demand visitation, and when your daughter hops in your arms, she has holes in her socks. And that's your fault, but by God, you're right. And my daughter hopped up in my arms one more time, and I couldn't stand it. Because without saying a word, her little Cuban eyes said, "Daddy, if you love me, why are you dressing me this way?" And I had to go to my sponsor, and me and my sponsor talked, and we had a plan of action. And I had to start treating a boss like a sponsor, and I had to start treating my job like a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with some type of level of respect, and quit going to work expecting to get paid, and just going to work to work. Well, what's happened is I've held that job ever since. Alcoholics Anonymous has made me a plumber. They took me out of the gutter and stuck me in the sewer, for Christ's sakes. But I tell you, I've kept in contact with that little girl because the women in AA, the women in Alcoholics Anonymous told me, "You may not be somebody's husband anymore, but you'll always be somebody's father. Don't you ever let that little girl wonder where you're at. Don't you ever let her wonder where her daddy's at. And if she's in Phoenix, you go see her. If you can talk in Seattle, you can drive to Phoenix and see your daughter. What's more spiritual? And don't write her in that plain yellow paper. Write her in Pocahontas paper, for God's sakes." Well, I've been doing that. And I had those daughter-daddy dates with my daughter. And not too long ago, my daughter called me up. And she says, "Daddy, the kids are making fun of me because I'm so smart." She says, "Did that ever happen to you?" I said, "Hell yes, you know. And happened to me this morning, for God's sakes, you know." Well, I want to tell you about the last time I seen my little girl. On our little daughter-daddy date, my little girl's sitting across from me. She's 20 years old. She's got her mom's earrings on. She's got a safety pin in her eye. She's got a ball bearing in her nose. She's got a ball bearing in her tongue. She's got a chain to her wallet. She's got a tattoo on her tummy. And she's looking at me and she says, "Daddy, what are you looking at?" And I said, "The most British little girl I've ever seen in my life." You know why? You know why? It's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's because every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a bunch of jugheads who are all pierced and tattooed, and they've got their bandanas on, and they've got their jewelry on, and they got their tattoos on, and behind every piercing and every tattoo, there's an alky in there, and that's who I talk to. I don't talk to your Raider shirt. I talk to you. You taught me that. You lock eyes with that alky. And behind every tattoo and every piercing of that little girl, behind all of that masquerade, there's a little girl in there, and I love her. That's who I talk to. Regardless of what she's wearing, regardless of what she's like when she's in that room, that's what I talk to. And newcomer, regardless of where you've come from and what you've done, you have never sunken too low to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not telling you anything here, but I'd like to extend an invitation to you. An invitation to a way of life. An invitation to a way of life far beyond anything you can imagine. An invitation to life that the only thing that you're going to have to get used to is being divinely inconvenienced for the rest of your damn life. Because everything about AA goes against the grain. But I tell you what happens to losers like me who've got a busy head. Is they take the most decent thing you have, which is your feet, and lo and behold, one of these days, after going to your meetings, your same meetings all the week, and talking to those same people, and having that same commitment, one of these days, you're going to be sitting at home, and about an hour before the meeting, you're going to go, "I'm not going. I am not going. I am not going. He's going to be there. She's going to be there. I'm not going. I'm not going." And before you know it, you'll find yourself taking a shower, making a coffee, and driving to the meeting while your head's saying, "I'm not going, I'm not going, I'm not going." Alcoholics Anonymous has trained my feet. It's the longest thing I've ever done against my will my entire life, man. You know, and everything about it goes against the grain, which is why it works so good. This is a very important weekend to me because I'm with you, and even more important than that is that it's my 10th anniversary with my little wife, Rosie. And I know you're thinking, "You big jackass, why ain't you at home with your wife?" Well, I tell you, I celebrated this anniversary last weekend with my wife. But Saturday morning was our anniversary, and when she woke up, she found a letter in her purse. And that letter in her purse told her to go into my office and to look to the left, and she'll see a white box over there by my filing cabinet. And for her to go into that white box and open up that box, and that she would sure find happiness. And she opened up that box and found a new ring and a necklace. And I told her, I can't wait to see you again. I met my wife in Alcoholics Anonymous 10 years ago. I was speaking in a meeting in Downey, one of those meetings that I didn't want to go to. And I got to this meeting and I started talking and I fell in love with this little Nicaraguan lady. I couldn't keep my eyes off her, man. And at the end of the meeting, I followed her out to a car like a lost terrier, you know? You know, and she's trying to get into her car and she says, do you like the backpack by any chance? And I says, I love it, you know? Well, I've never camped a day in my life, man, you know. I spent enough time out there, you know, but I figured anything to get into the damn tent, you know. And I tell you, I've been calling that lady ever since. And 10 years ago, we got to join and marry. And I tell you, I'm not number one in her life. I'm number four on her list. And we talked at a conference a couple years ago, and she did, and I was in the audience. And after she was done, some jackass came up to me, and he says, how do you like being number four on her list? And I says, if you felt the way I felt about AA, my friend, you'd be happy to be on the damn list. I am so happy I'm not number one in her life. You see, when it's time for me to go, there's no tugging. And when there's time for her to go, there's no tugging. But my God, when we are together, there is nothing like it. There is nothing like love that you feel in alcohol. I don't want to hurt her. She's the only woman that I've told other women about. And I don't ever want to see that look in her eye that I've up to my own nonsense again. She's teaching me how not to cuss. One of these days we'll do that. You know what I mean? And I can't wait to be in her arms again. She lost her mother the last couple weeks. 2 weeks ago, her mother died. And my sponsor advice was this: you go be there for her. You go be there for her without giving her any advice. You just be there for her. And I tell you, she would be busy during the day and she would have things to do, but at nighttime, she could come home and she could lay her head on my arm and know that she could sob there and she could cry there and she wouldn't have to hear me question her or do anything, that she found comfort in my arms. My God, thank you so much for that. Thank you so much for that. If you're new, I want to close this down because I know we got to go. Several years ago, I used to talk for a man in Flagstaff. Every year I'd go up there and he had this big, beautiful house, custom-made cabin. And in every window of that cabin, he had a picture window. And in every window, he had a peak view of the mountains. Whether you're in the den or the bathroom or the living room, you could look out a window and see the peak view of these beautiful mountains like you have here. And I tell you, as I look at my life today, every window of my life has got a window. Every area of my life, I've got a picture and you're in it. Every area of my life, I can't help but seeing the faces of the people of Alcoholics Anonymous who have come before in my life and who have just presented themselves in my life. And I love looking at your faces. And though I may not see the voice and the face of a loving God everywhere I go, I know this: that on a Saturday night in Washington, I see table after table and row of people who should be dead, who should be locked up, who should be put away or should be buried. And look at us. Look at us tonight. Look at us all weekend. We're happy, we're joyous, and we're free. Now, we may not see his face, and we may not hold his hand, but man, we've been playing in the evidence all night long. Thank you.